Okay, so this evening I wanted to study with you a number of sources that pertain to the holiday of Hanukkah, and I want to see if we can kind of dig down to the core of what this holiday is all about, and I want to frame it by asking a couple of questions up front. One question is a famous question, which is, why is Hanukkah 8 days? Okay, so that's an unusual number of days for a holiday. You know that the miracle was really only 7 days, because after all, the cruise of oil was enough to burn for one, so the fact that it burned for eight, the miraculous piece of that narrative is only 7 days. So that's one question that I want to think about with you. Another question that I want to think about with you is that we do something unusual on Hanukkah. We light a Hanukkiah in shul, separate and apart from the lighting that we do at home. It has its own set of halachos. It's supposed to be lit in the south of the shul, just as the menorah was lit in the south of the temple. It's supposed to be lit by someone, even if they're going to be lighting later at home. You know, it has nothing to do with his individual obligation. He's going to go home and light a menorah. But independent of that, he's going to light a menorah in shul, and I want to kind of understand what that's about. You know, we don't have a matzah eating ceremony in shul. No, you have a mitzvah to eat matzah, and wherever you eat it, that's the end of the story. Why is there a separate mitzvah that has to do with lighting a menorah specifically in shul? So what I want to do is try to understand a phenomenon that appears in the halachic literature, identify it, explain what it might be about, and then use that as a kind of means by which to address and hopefully answer some of these specific questions, and then dig deeper into understand what Hanukkah might really be all about. Okay, so it begins. My conversation begins with a Gemara that comes from the second chapter of Shabbos, and I have it for you in source number one, a famous Gemara, a famous machlokas. Let's learn it together. The Gemara tells us, Tana Rabbanan mitzvos Chanukah ner ish ubesa. Okay, and I want to focus on a few different components that get noted in this Gemara. So first of all, the Gemara tells us that the mitzvah of Chanukah is about ner ish ubesa. Okay, so interesting formulation, and just flag it for a second, we'll come back to it in a minute. But the obligation is not specifically on the person, but it's the person, the candle, and their home. Okay? Unusual formulation, we'll return to it in a second. Next, v'amahadrin ner l'kol echad, v'achad, v'amahadrin min amahadrin, v'shamrei omrim yom rishon madlik ashmona, mikan ve'elach poches v'holech, Okay, and now that it sounds like, and there's a few ways to read this Gemara, which we're not going to get into right this second, but it sounds like the basic obligation is one candle. Okay, basic obligation is one candle. There's now something called mehadrin, which is let's say a nicer form of the performance of the mitzvah, and that's a candle for every person. Okay, so let's say there's five members of your family, so you'd light five candles on Hanukkah. And then there's something called mahadrin mina mahadrin, which is the highest possible level. Okay, the highest possible level, and what is that? So that's a machlokas. So the two ways to understand how to fulfill this mitzvah of mahadrin mina mahadrin. The first position is the position of Beis Shammai. What's Beis Shammai's position? Beis Shammai's position is, on the first night you light how many candles?
Eight
candles, and then you descend gradually from there. Okay, so you'd start on the first night with eight candles, and on the last night you'd end up with one candle. Okay. Beis Hillel says the opposite. This is our practice. You start with one candle on the first night, and you make your way up gradually to eight candles by the time you get to the last night of Hanukkah. Okay. Now, what's that debate all about? Amar Ula. So Ula said, "Pligi ba trei amurai b'marava." There were two Amoraim in the west, in Palestine, Rabbi Yossi bar Avin, Rabbi Yossi bar Zveda. They both were named Rabbi Yossi. And they had an opinion as to what this debate was about. So Chad Amar, Taimed Bei Shamar Keneged Yamim Nechnasin, V'Taimed Bei Silo Keneged Yamim Yamim Hayotzi. So one position was that it was a debate about counting, whether you're basically counting how many days remain versus how many days are left. That's one way to interpret the machlokes about between Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel, a kind of surface level interpretation of the debate. And there's another, the alternative way to understand the debate is more fundamental. B'chadam artamed Beis Shammai keneged parei hachag, v'tamed Beis Hillel demalin b'kodesh ve'ein maridin. A fundamental philosophical debate about how to conduct yourself when it comes to fulfilling the mitzvah of Hanukkah candles. Beis Shammai says you start with 8 and go down to 1. Why? He says because the Hanukkah candles correspond to the number of sacrifices that are offered on Sukkot. The number of sacrifices that are offered on Sukkot. So what is the number of sacrifices that are offered on Sukkot? So you have 7 days of Sukkot. So you start with 13, and then you go down each day. 13, 12, 11, 10, 9, 8, 7. Okay. That's Beis Shammai. He says that the number of Hanukkah candles is modeled after the number of sacrifices on Sukkot. And Beis Hillel, totally different rationale. Malin b'kodesh ve'ein moridin. Right, famous principle that says that whenever you talk about issues of holiness, you ascend. The goal is to keep going upward rather than the opposite. So we want to establish a positive trajectory. You start with one, and you keep adding with each succeeding day.
Somehow, just intuitively, it seems to me that if you start with all eight, you have a much... Then you can come down from that, but you've established that it's Hanukkah.
Okay, so you like Beis Shammai. You think Beis Shammai makes more sense. Okay, look, his position didn't win out, but it's preserved. And I actually want to talk about it. It's going to be more important actually tonight for purposes of our conversation than Beis Hillel.
So is he upset? Are you sad or upset when you won the first night? How do you feel?
So what do? Do you light only the first night?
No. Are you sad about that already? No.
So I've not met, my experience is limited, but I've not met anyone who follows the position of Beis Shammai. Someone did tell me this past Saturday night that they were in attendance at a Karaite wedding. So I was not aware that there were Karaites in New York City. I don't think the Karaites have anything to do with, I don't think the Karaites have anything to do with Hanukkah. Right. I don't think that made their cut. But again, I say that by way of saying that maybe one day I'll meet someone who follows the position Beis Shammai. It'll be the first night of Hanukkah, and they'll be there with 8 candles. Okay. Look, 2,000 years ago, they would have said 8 candles on the first night of Hanukkah. That wouldn't have been the craziest thing in the world. Half the population was following Beis Shammai, and that's what they did. Okay. So there are 3 pieces that I want to unpack from this little section of the Gemara that we've read. The first one is this unusual formulation of Ner Ishu Beiso. The second one is this notion of hiddur mitzvah, the different levels of the mitzvah, the basic, the better, and the best. And then the third we'll come back to is this business about do we light from 1 to 8 or 8 to or 8 to 1. So first things first, ner ish ubeso. Okay, so what the Gemara means is that the basic halacha, the basic mitzvah, is for one person to light one candle in the house. Whether you live by yourself or you have a family of 16, there's one candle in the house. The mitzvah is ner ishu beiso. That is the minimum obligation. And by the way, we've not introduced Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel yet. Every night of Hanukkah would be one candle for the house. And that is, by the way, the basic halacha, which is to say, if you find yourself stranded, it's the sixth night of Hanukkah and you only have one, light the candle. Say the brachos. That's the mitzvah. Not the most pristine form of the mitzvah, but that's the mitzvah to light a candle. Okay, so I just want to zoom in for a moment on that formulation, ner ishu beiso. which is unusual. We could have figured out simpler, more straightforward ways to say that the basic formulation is for each person to light one candle or for every home to light a candle. Be that as it may, what's this notion of, right? Usually we think of mitzvos, so we're having a Pesach Seder, so I have a mitzvah to eat matzah, and you have a mitzvah to eat matzah. It's not like, oh, we have one Seder, we'll have one matzah, right? We come to shul on Rosh Hashanah, and you say, you know, I'm stepping out for a few minutes, you blow shofar, you'll be, no, it could be one person, you know, performs the mitzvah for other people, but everyone in the room is obligated to fulfill the mitzvah, right? The mitzvah pertains to the person, and as such, what is this notion of the mitzvah of Hanukkah pertaining to the home? Right? That's fundamentally what we're saying. If you have roommates, so no, again, mitzvah minam haj. So the highest form will be for everyone, but the basic mitzvah, the home. The home has one candle. One person, 10 people, 20 people. The mitzvah is on the home. So what is that? What is that about? Okay. So I'm not going to answer the question, but I just want to point out the phenomenon, which I think is unusual, and just tie it to a very different mitzvah or very different description of a mitzvah. And you'll see where all this is going, even though it may seem a little opaque at the beginning. And that's the mitzvah is tied to the halacha of sukkah that I have for you in source number 2. So the Torah tells us that for 7 days you will dwell in the sukkah. Basukos teshvu shivas yamim. So the Gemara famously picks up on the word teshvu, that you will dwell in the sukkah, and it tells you a governing principle for sukkahs. Amar abai teshvu ke'en taduru. Teshvu ke'en taduru. That you live in the sukkah the way that you live in your home. So this has many applications. The Gemara says, if you have nice dishes, take them out of your home and bring them into the sukkah. If you have nice furnishings, take them out of your home and bring them into the sukkah. So that for the 7 days that you're living in your sukkah, you're really living there the way that you would live in your home. On the flip side, the formulation creates exemptions. It starts raining and the water starts to drip on you. So the Gemara says, you go inside. Right? If your house had a leak, you wouldn't stay there. You'd move to a house that didn't have a leak. Same thing. You have to dwell there the way that you would dwell in your home. And if the situation is such that it's not habitable for one reason or another, so the same way that you wouldn't dwell in a home that had a leak, you move inside. Many applications of this principle. But I just wanted to note that there is this kind of parallel between the home-centric nature of the mitzvah of Hanukkah and the home-centric nature of the mitzvah of Sukkot. Okay? Point number one. Point number two. Mehadrin mina mehadrin, this notion of hidur mitzvah. Okay? So hidur mitzvah applies to all mitzvahs. The pasuk says, we say it in Az Yashir every morning, Zek keli v'anvehu. This is my God, and I will beautify him. So the Gemara says, we're not in a position to beautify God, so what is the force of that formulation? So the Gemara answers, you can't beautify God, but you could beautify his mitzvos. So if you have a shofar, it should be a beautiful shofar. If you have a lulav, it should be a beautiful lulav. If you have a pair of tefillin, it should be a beautiful pair of tefillin. And on and on and on. And this is the basis, by the way, for the centuries-old tradition that we have of having a kiddush cup. Silver kiddush cup. It doesn't need to be a silver kiddush. You can make a kiddush on a $3 glass cup. It doesn't matter. Right? A piece of porcelain. What difference is it? No, it should be beautiful. It's a mitzvah. We care about it. We want it to be special. And so we beautify it. Right? And that is any mitzvah that we have. Somebody has an atara on their talis. Somebody has a beautiful mezuzah case, the silver crown on the Torah. It all comes from that principle, Zek keli v'anvehu, hidur mitzvah. If you're doing a mitzvah, it's an opportunity to beautify the mitzvah. Again, if you don't beautify the mitzvah, and the mitzvah still counts, you could have make kiddush on the regular. It's fine, that's kiddush too, it doesn't matter. Right? If your shofar is an ugly shofar, it's a kosher shofar, it doesn't matter. But to the extent that it's possible, In a perfect world, you try to beautify the mitzvahs. Okay. So what's the means by which to beautify the mitzvah and make it even more spectacular on Hanukkah? So you have these levels, right? And it's quite out of the ordinary. Again, you could talk about it with any mitzvah, but to be so explicit about it and to basically bake it into the mitzvah, right, to the extent that if you stop somebody on the street and said, how many candles are you supposed to light on the sixth night of Hanukkah? No one would even know that what they're doing is the highest form, right? They would say, six candles, six night. Everybody knows, right? Ask any secular American Jew. Everybody knows. Right? So we've baked it in. It's become standard, right? Because the notion of Hidur on Hanukkah is so kind of fundamental to the mitzvah that we do it almost automatically. There's one other time where the notion of Hidur, again, Hidur applies all the time, but almost always as something discretionary. To the extent we can do it, we do it. But there's one other time where it's basically baked into the mitzvah and is fundamental, and that is on what holiday? On Sukkot. Because one of the four species, one of the Arba Minim, is actually called pre-Eitz Hadar. Right? It's the formulation in the Torah itself, and this is Rashi's understanding of this formulation. So I'll just give you a couple examples. Rashi says this in a couple of different places. So it's true about all the Arba Minim. So for instance, the Gemara wants to know, and you'll forgive me, we're going a little far afield, but you'll see where it's all going. The Gemara wants to know if the top of the lulav is cut off. Is that a kosher lulav? And the Mishnah says, no. Niktam rosho, pasul, disqualified. So Rashi, Johnny on the spot, says, why is it pasul? And he says, delo have hadar, because it is not a fulfillment of the obligation of the notion that the Arba Minim have to be hadar. They have to be beautiful, not just regular, but beautiful. In the case of the Arba Minim, you know, it's very subjective. And you see this all the time, meaning what I think is a beautiful lulav, and what I think is a beautiful esrog, so I want it a little greener, you like it a little more yellow, I a little rounder, a little more. Okay, so that's an open question. What constitutes beautiful? But again, Rashi's telling you it's fundamental to the mitzvah, and if you're telling me that something is objectively not beautiful because most people believe that a headless lulav is not beautiful, so it's not that it's problematic because it's not a lulav, it's problematic because it's not hadar. Okay, and Rashi says the same thing when it comes to the esrog, source number four. He says, when it comes to the esrog, everyone requires that it be hadar. Aval esrog, the Gemara says, esrog divrei hakol by hadar. No one disagrees. Everyone in the world subscribes to the notion that an esrog, again, fundamentally must be hadar, to hadar ksipe, because that's the pasuk. It says it right, black on white, in the text. Indispensable component of the mitzvah, not just discretionary component of the mitzvah, indispensable component of the mitzvah. And again, notice the connection. Maybe there are other examples, I can't think of any, where hadar figures so prominently in the definition of the mitzvah, Chanukah and Sukkot. Okay. And that brings us to the third point. Stop me at any point with questions or comments. And that brings me to the third point in this little Gemara that we looked at in source number one, and that is the reason for Beis Shammai's position. Beis Shammai says, start on the first day with eight candles and remove one on each succeeding night. 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Why? What's the basis for that notion? Beis Hillel, we understand. Malin v'kodesh v'ein marid. Beis Shammai doesn't argue with that. He subscribes to that principle too. You know, that principle, again, has wide application. The Mishnayos talk about if you want to take a talis cover and repurpose it for a paroch, right? So what has a higher kedusha? You're allowed to go up. You can't go down. Can you turn a Beis Medrash into a shul? Can you turn a shul? So what's the hierarchy? And you have to be ascending, right? Nobody disagrees with that position. The question is, what's the more important principle in this topic? So Beis Hillel says the most important principle, the guiding principle, is Malim Kodesh Ve'en Morid. Beis Shammai says, I agree with you, that's a guiding principle, but in this case, there's a more important principle. And what is it? A model that I have from Sukkis. What's the model that I have from Sukkis? The model that I have from Sukkis is the source that I have for you in source number 5. We don't have to read the whole thing line by line, but you could see that on each succeeding day of the festival, you bring one cow fewer in the communal offerings. So we have this notion of reducing the number. Again, it's totally from left field, right? On its face, what does one thing have anything to do with the next? But there's a model, again, from way out there, from literally the cows, right? The bulls of Sukkis. So the number of bulls gets reduced on each succeeding day. And so on Hanukkah, we reduce the number of candles on each succeeding day. Ma'inyan Shmita Eitzah Har Sinai, right? What has one got to do with the other? But again, I'm just highlighting here these parallels between Hanukkah and Sukkis. Number one, the notion of the home being the center. Number two, the notion of Hidur being intrinsic. And now number three, again, guiding principle for Beis Hillel, the way he structures the entire candle, that's the one mitzvah we have, right? The entire mitzvah is going to be guided by the notion of how we reduce the number of sacrifices on the holiday of Sukkis. What does Sukkis have to do with Hanukkah? So far, so good. Let me make it a little worse before it gets better. Okay. So, let me ask you a different question. This comes up in a different guise in Manhattan, but factoring out apartment buildings for a second, if you just have a freestanding house, right, and you're lighting candles in your house, so what is the maximum height at which you can light your candles? What's the maximum height? Okay.
What do you mean from the ground?
From the ground, yeah. Let's say you have
maximum
a...
Maximum height.
Is it
what
like the maximum
eight?
A
sukkah
long?
What?
Dr. Kish? 8? 20 amos. That is the winning number. 20 amos, which is roughly 30 feet. Roughly 30 feet. Okay? So so again, in Manhattan, you know, it's just think of the ground that you're on as opposed to from the ground of the street level. Right. So in your home, let's say you had a 50-foot ceiling, right? And you decided for some reason you wanted to light it at the 40th foot. No, that's too high, right? 20 amos from the ground. That's the source that you have here in number 6. Source number 6. Gemara in Bava Kama, Amar Rav Kahana, Darash of Nasan Bar Minyan, Mishmeder Rabbi Tanchum, Ner Chanaka Sheinicha Lamala Mi'esrim Ama Psula. A Chanukah candle which is lit at a height higher than 20 amos is disqualified. That's not okay. Just like sukkah. Sukkah. What is sukkah? What does 20 amos have to do with sukkah?
The height of the
sukkah. Right. That's the very first mishnah in sukkah. Perek Aleph Mishnah Aleph. The mishnah tells us source number 7. Sukkah shigavol lamalam esrim ama psula. Exact same formulation. Right. Any sukkah, again, the defining feature of the sukkah is the schach. So if the schach is placed at a height higher than 20 amos, the sukkah is disqualified. It's not a sukkah. Not a sukkah. Okay. Why, by the way? When it comes to sukkah, let's just say...
It's
not permanent. So it's actually a debate on the first daf of sukkah. What's the disqualification of being too high? So the answer that we actually accept is that if it's too high, it's out of the field of vision. Everyone has a field of vision, and you have, I don't know what it's called, this peripheral vision, right, which is sort of what you kind of notice. If you're looking straight ahead, you have some peripheral vision. What's the, again, there must be a term for it, but what's the vision that you have upward when you just kind of look straight ahead? So it's not unlimited, right, especially in a relatively enclosed space. At some point, you stop being able to notice it. So if you have a sukkah that's a normal-sized sukkah, and the schach is, you know, 50 feet high, you're not going to see the schach. It's going to be, you could look up and see it, but if you're just kind of looking in the normal course of things, you're not going to see it. And if you can't see it, you're not going to even know you're in a sukkah. It defeats the whole purpose, and it's not a sukkah. Same thing when it comes to Hanukkah. You have to be able to see the thing. Someone is supposed to be able to pass by and say, oh, Hanukkah, it's a Hanukkah candle. If your average passerby is not going to notice it because it's out of the field of vision, that's not a Hanukkah candle. Disqualified.
So what is the size of an amma?
So an amma is, it's a debate, it's the distance between one's elbow and the tip of one's middle finger, and we usually assume it's somewhere between 18 and 24 inches. Basically, you know, for these kinds of issues, we'd say a foot and a half, and you know, you're talking about 30 feet, which is kind of intuitive. It's sort of what you would assume if you could just notice it on the way home. You know, you could sort of see what's happening on the second story of buildings that you pass. On the fifth story, unless you're looking for it, you don't see it. That's sort of the range of vision. Okay, so add that to the list of parallels between Hanukkah and Sukkot. Let me give you a couple more. Okay, you ready? Mm-hmm. Before we get too obscure and before we try to tie things together, look at the Mishnah in source
why
number 8.
Why did you need? Why was it needed to go back to something from the Torah for the parallel? In other words, why not keep Hanukkah?
Good, so I want to come to that in a second. Yes, meaning I'm going
to
get...
In other words, you're doing it relative to something from the Torah.
Correct.
As opposed to absolutely...
Correct.
To stand on its own.
So if you have the patience, I'll just give you two or three more quick hits. just to really flesh out that these are not random parallels, but they kind of go on ad infinitum almost. And then I want to open up the question of why. Why all of these parallels? And to the extent that these are conscious, why would the progenitors of this holiday have modeled Hanukkah on Sukkot of all holidays?
The dedication of the...
Yeah, so hang on to that, because we're going to come back. That's going to be very important in a second.
The rededication of the Mizbeah, I think, right?
We're going to see. Yeah. So hold on to that. We're going to see that in a second.
They have to put the old stones in Geniza.
Okay. So just a couple more, just to really drive the point home. You'll see in source number 8. So the Mishnah says, let me just tell you about a ceremony that used to take place in temple times on Sukkot, describing the Simchas Beis HaShoeva. But Motzei Yom Tov Rishon Shel Chag. Okay. On the first night after the first day of Yom Tov, what would they do? Yardu Ezras Nashim. They would go out into the what was called the Ezras Nashim, literally the women's courtyard of the temple. Umetaknin sham tikun gadol, and they would do some kind of great ceremony there. What would be set up? Menoros shel zahav hayusham. They would have these great menoros, okay, these great candelabras that were set up, the arba sfalim shel zahav berosheim, and there would be these troughs, these buckets made of gold at their top, the arba sulamos lekol echad bechad, each one would have four ladders ascending so that people could go up and light them, the arba yeladim yipir chekuhuna, and some specially designated children of Kohanim would be on hand. Ubi adayan kadim shel shemen shelmeh beshulog, and they would have these containers of oil, shen matila chol safal safal, and they'd go and pour them into each of the buckets, and then they'd light them. Okay. So again, a ceremony on Sukkot involving giant menorahs. Source number 9.
Did women go to it?
Everyone participated. Everyone participated.
Together? You mean, yeah.
So I don't know if the Gemara talks about where everyone specifically stood. I don't remember offhand.
I think they said that because it was becoming very that's why they built the Aliyah for women.
That I think is the
because women were there,
right?
But because it was like there was too much
potential for
whatever, then they built the Aliyah
to keep everyone a little separate.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. Let me just share with you a Rokeach. This is a 12th, 13th century source. In source number 9, the Rokeach writes the following. He just says, "Beparshas Emor al Kohanim Hiskol Shabbos veRegalim Pesach Atzeres Rosh Hashanah v'Yom Kippur Sukkos." So he says, you know, when you have this is in Vayikra chapter Chaf Gimel chapter 23, the Torah outlines for you all of the holidays. You have the Shalosh Regalim, Rosh Hashanah, and Yom Kippur. Vayidaber Moshe Esmo Adei Hashem al Bnei Yisrael, etc. V'samich Le, and then right after that. Vayikhu elecha shemen zayis kasis lemor. This is right after that you get the mitzvah of candle lighting the menorah. He says, Revez lechanukah. It's a hint, right? It didn't exist yet. But right after Sukkot, which is the last holiday listed, comes the holiday of Chanukah. And then just one more parallel. It's a little obscure in sources number 10 and 11. Okay, I'll just summarize it for you in the interest of time. There is a principle in halacha that has a number of applications, but two of the most prominent are here on Chanukah and Sukkot. The principle is something called huktza lemitzvasa, which is to say we usually think of muktza as a Shabbos issue. Something's muktzah, so you can't move it on Shabbos because it's basically designated for a non-Shabbos purpose. Right? That's the kind of cliff notes on what muktzah is about. Okay? So it's muktzah in the sense that it's set aside for non-Shabbos use, so we're not using it on Shabbos. So what would it mean to say something is huktzah lemitzvasa? Huktzah lemitzvasa means that something is designated specifically for mitzvah use, such that it cannot be used for any other purpose. The two most prominent examples that I know of are from Sukkot and Chanukah. Okay. So the Shulchan Aruch paskens this way. This is based on the Gemara in source number 11. He says, you know, what if you have like a piece of the wall? Let's say you have a four-wall sukkah, and you decide in the middle of sukkahs, you know, you don't need a four-wall sukkah, but you have some other purpose for the fourth wall. It'd be a perfectly kosher sukkah, but you just want to repurpose one of the walls during Chol HaMoed because you need it for something else. Okay, or even more practical example, you have some decorations that are hanging from the schach, and you decide that. You know, you don't like the way it looks. You want to take one down and do something else with it. Or one of them falls and you want to put it to some other use. So the halacha is, can't do it. Huktza lemitzvasa. Unless you made some special tanai, some special stipulation up front, the working assumption is that is designated, the wall, the schach, the decorate, whatever it is, designated for use for the mitzvah purposes for 7 days to the exclusion of any other purpose. Okay? Huktza lemitzvasa can't be used for anything else. You pour your olive oil into your chanukiah and you light it and it burns for half an hour. It's gonna. Then you decide, you know what? I have some other purpose for that oil. The strictly speaking, the halacha is, too bad. I mean, if you were to stipulate, you could do whatever you want. You want to stipulate, but objectively, sort of the default is you're lighting it for Chanukah. It's for Chanukah. No other use. Huktza lemitzvasa. Okay. So again, just a kind of footnote on this broad theme of, once again, this kind of obscure notion rears its head and pops up in Chanukah and Sukkot. So what is all this about? What do we make of these seemingly endless parallels between Chanukah and Sukkot? And now I throw it out to you. Right? You're a Maccabee. You just rededicated the temple. You decide this is a big deal. This is not just a small moment in this local issue. This is a monumental moment in the course of Jewish history. We're going to commemorate this holiday forevermore. So you sit around and you have a committee gets together, the committee for the formation of Chanukah, and they start throwing out ideas. And one of them, one of the committee members says, "Well, Chanukah candles, we should definitely do something with the candles. That was a big thing. Well, how many candles and how many days? So would any of you have piped up and said, Sukkot, we should model Chanukah after Sukkot. That's my big idea." So, I don't want to put words in anyone's mouth. It seems like something like that happened. What was the big idea? And that was the winning solution. Somebody else said, one day. Somebody said 2 days. Somebody said 8 days. Eight, isn't that so onerous? We don't have a... Where did you get 8 days? Sukkot? What is the explanation for why, of all the models that we could have had? And again, there's 5 biblical holidays. Pesach, Shavuot, Sukkot, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur. Presumably, it's going to be modeled on something from the Torah. Why Sukkot? Okay, so I think that's actually a very important point, which is on the calendar, that is the most recent holiday.
So it was on everybody's mind.
Exactly.
Well,
exactly.
Well, also related to that is, if Sukkot is Chag HaAsif, it's supposed to be sort of like the end of that cycle of, like, the beginning of the cycle is Pesach, the beginning of the harvest, and so it's sort of the end of the harvest. So what you're saying with Chanukah is like, well, that wasn't your real end. This is like the, because this is, the harvesting of like the olives, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is Chanukah. So like, this is actually the end of the Chag HaAsif. Like this, that wasn't, this, the tekufa of Chag HaAsif has actually extended to this point. And so this is, it's like a grand, whatever.
Grand finale. An extension of what it is that we're commemorating on Sukkot. Okay, beautiful. I think that's very important.
It's not it, but it's
beautiful. No, I don't want to say that, meaning I wasn't there.
I never heard that Chanukah was...
And olives. I didn't know that olives were...
The olives are not ready that early. Right, the olives, right? They sit on the tree, but,
mm-hmm.
But I think like this is now the period when they really do take them into the house, because then I guess...
Right, meaning when winter really comes, so then you're done.
Then you harvest them.
Yeah. Okay, so let me share with you one piece of the puzzle, and then I want to share another. So the Aruch HaShulchan, and again, this is one of the questions we started with, which is, why 8 days? Again, famous question. The miracle is really only 7. Right, if there's enough oil to burn for one day, so the miraculous component of 8 days of burning oil is 7. So the Aruch HaShulchan says, what's the notion of an 8-day holiday? So he writes in source number 12, "Bi'otam lezemavor b'sefer chashmonai." He says, go back to the book. The book of the Maccabees didn't make it into the canon. It's not part of Tanakh. And because it's not part of Tanakh, we know it much less. Nobody ever sits around and studies the book of Maccabees, right? 4 books of the Maccabees, 1, 2, 3, 4. So the Aruch HaShulchan, meaning this is a text that's known, we have the text. He says, read the text, it's something you'll find in it. Ve'otam lezeh mevor b'sefer chashmonai lefi sh'al yedei ha'gzeros batlu az milahakriv b'chag ha'sukos ha'avar uvishmini atzeres. He says, you know what happened as a result of the gzeros that were enacted by the Yevanim, by the Hellenists, there were prohibitions against Jewish worship. Part of the prohibition against Jewish worship was a prohibition against offering the normal sacrifices in the temple. So, go back to the Book of Maccabees. The Book of Maccabees, we'll see in a second, says that year, right, however long the revolt was, the war was. So, and this comes back to Gaby's important point, which was the most recent holiday, which was affected by the political turmoil of the moment, was Sukkot. And so there was no Sukkot for the Jewish people in the land of Israel in that year of this story. Okay. So they couldn't do it. They couldn't bring their sacrifices to the temple on Sukkot. They couldn't bring their sacrifices to the temple on Shmini Atzeres. Ve'lachein lezikaron ze asu shmona yamim Chanukah. So they decided, if we're going to make this into a festival, let's make it an 8-day festival as a means by which to acknowledge and commemorate the fact that we just missed an 8-day holiday, so this will be our compensatory holiday. We missed the 8 days of Sukkot, 7 days of Sukkot, 1 day Shmini Atzeres. Now that we've regained our sovereignty and our autonomy and our capacity to use the temple, let's have an 8-day holiday.
How did you tie Shmini Atzeres to the 7 days of
Sukkot? So with the 7 days of Sukkot, but Shmini Atzeres.
Ah, okay.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Sounds like they were actually celebrating. They said, you know, with Mulavim.
Yeah, so this gets even better, right? So the Aruch HaShulchan doesn't give you all the details, but if you go back to the Book of Maccabees, this is 2 Maccabees chapter 10, translated into an English, translated into a language that we understand. 2 Maccabees chapter 10, and they celebrated, this is Surah 13, and they celebrated the 8 days in joy. By the way, Simcha is a major component here, meaning Simcha, Vayisa Ach Sameach. Simcha is the defining element of Sukkot, and so it becomes the defining element of Chanukah. They celebrated the 8 days in joy like Chag HaSukkot and recalled how a little while before, during Sukkot, they had been wandering in the mountains and caverns like wild animals. Therefore, with branches of myrtle and branches of beauty and date palm branches in their hands, Arba Minim, they gave thanks to He who permitted them to succeed in purifying His temple, and with the consensus they established for the entire Jewish nation to celebrate each year these days. Wow! So it wasn't just 8 days to correspond to the most recent holiday that they hadn't been able to celebrate. They were actually celebrating Sukkot later on the calendar. Who would have dreamed such a thing was even possible, right? We're not saying in Rabbinic Judaism, I don't know of any precedent, right, other than Pesach Sheni, where the Torah itself tells you, if you miss the first one, you have a second opportunity exactly a month later. This is some random...
Shlomo extended Sukkot, remember, an extra week?
Yes, so that's true. But now we're talking about not extending the holiday, but re-celebrating the holiday in a compensatory fashion.
Yeah.
2+ months later, right, the Torah doesn't tell you, sit in a sukkah on the 15th of the 7th month, and if that doesn't work out, you know, do it on any old day. Right? There's a specific time that you have to sit in a sukkah. So again, putting that aside, what a fascinating historical note, right, to recognize that on the holiday, the first ever Chanukah doubled as a holiday of Sukkot.
Okay. The other thing is that they were holding it in order they give thanks. So it's almost like that's the hollow, right?
So yes.
It's almost like that's part of their hollow. And that hollow then becomes, hollow is integral to Hanukkah.
Yeah, that's an excellent point.
That's very good.
Yeah, the simcha and the hallel is intrinsic.
Right.
Yeah, that and again you see it almost directly from the text. Okay, so I just want to kind of wrap up with one final thought, and a couple people already mentioned this notion. So there's a calendar reason to integrate the two. There's a historical reason to connect the two, Sukkot and Hanukkah. And there is, I want to say, a philosophical reason, which is also a historical reason as well. And that goes back to the 8th chapter of the Book of Kings. And you can see it here in source number 14. When Shlomo finished building the first temple, the Navi tells us that he gathered all of the people of the nation, and they had a celebration. They had a dedication. They had a ceremony. And when did that take place? Beyerach ha'etanim bechag hu chodesh hashvi'i, at the feast of the month of Etanim. That is the seventh month, the month of Tishrei, which is a reference to the holiday of Sukkot. So now imagine you're on the committee for the establishment of Hanukkah. So how do you see yourself in the grand sweep of Jewish history? What is Hanukkah? Hanukkah is the holiday of the rededication of the temple. So it's almost obvious. You say, well, when was the first dedication of the temple? The first dedication of the temple was Sukkot. So the temple holiday is always Sukkot. If this is going to be a temple holiday, let's model it on the first ever temple holiday, the holiday of Sukkot. And I think that helps answer the questions with which we began. Okay, the 8 days is now almost obvious, right? There's no other precedent. There's not other eights in the Torah, right? Pesach is 7 days, right? Rosh Hashanah is 2 days. Yom Kippur is 1 day. Shavuos is 1. We don't have an 8 day. What is 8 days? Meaning 7 days is the normal period of time. Right? Think of Torah Judaism. Think of Rabbinic Judaism. So a festival is 7 days in the Torah. Sheva brachos, right, which are based on, we just had it in the Parsha, right? Lavan. And so Sheva brachos, a week of celebration. We mourn Shiva. A week, meaning that's the unit. We have sevens. We don't have eights. Where does eight come from? There's only one model for eight, and that is Sukkot. It's so conspicuous, but once you see it, it's so obvious. Hanukkah is modeled on Sukkot, right? Sukkot plus Shmini Atzeres. It's the eight-day holiday because it's the temple dedication holiday. So obviously, if this is the holiday that commemorates the dedication or rededication of the temple and our capacity to use the temple again, we're going to model it on Sukkot. And it answers to the second question with which I began. Why is it that there's a special component on Hanukkah in the province of the shul? We have a public ceremony to light in every shul. There's a menorah in the shul, separate and apart from whatever's going on in anyone's home. It's not just Pirsumei Nisa, meaning that's a big deal. And Chabad gets lots of credit every time they put a big menorah on a truck and, you know, they find the biggest menorah to light on broad. That's beautiful. And that's Pirsumei Nisa, and that's great. And it all comes from this notion of Mahadrim Minamah. We should do everything we can to get the widest possible exposure to this to this mitzvah. The more, the merrier. We really want to. We really want to make sure as many people see this this candle or this set of candles as possible. So we light in shul because, well, that's a public place. So in your home, there's going to be X number of passers-by. In a shul, there's going to be 10X because that's a communal gathering place. But that's just one component, right? There's an entirely second and separate component, which is this is the temple holiday. So we light the Chanukiah in the temple. Now, in Orthodox Judaism in the 21st century, we don't call a shul a temple, only because the other denominations co-opted the expression. Right? They called it a temple. This is a historical footnote. Right? Reform Judaism said, we don't accept the notion of returning to Zion. There's not going to be a third temple. So this building over here, last week we called it a shul, today we call it a temple. Because this is our temple. And we're done. Right? And Berlin is the new Jerusalem. Right? It's all of a piece. So you're here, you arrived at the temple. What's that?
It's like what Yeravam ben Nevat did.
Right, exactly. Meaning, you're done. We have a shortcut for you. You just come right here. So, but I'm saying half in jest. Meaning, of course, this is a mikdash ma'at. Of course, it's a miniature temple. So again, we don't like to use that language because we reserve temple, capital T, for the temple because we're all planning to go back to the temple, in a messianic era. But the shul is the stand-in. It's our mikdash ma'at for the temple. So in the absence of the temple, we'll light a menorah in the shul. Again, there's not really another example I have in my head of where we do this, where we replicate the mitzvah that's going on at home and do it in shul as its own component. Meaning there are plenty of places over the course of the year where we do the davening in the shul, right? But this is nothing to do with the davening specifically. It has to do with the structure of the shul. We light the menorah in the shul, in the mikdash ma'at, because at the end of the day, this is the temple holiday. And the goal is to celebrate the rededication of the temple. So what does it mean? Right? What does it mean to celebrate this holiday in the diaspora? What does it mean to celebrate this holiday in the absence of the temple? So on some level, right, on some level, we are rekindling our national aspiration. And what we're saying is, it's our hope, it's our dream, it's our vision that speedily in our days, we won't be lighting just a candelabra in our home or in the shul, but we'll be lighting, right, the seven branch candelabra in a rebuilt temple in Jerusalem. That, I think, helps explain what it is that we're doing by re-emphasizing over and again all these connections between Sukkot and Hanukkah. We go back to the original temple holiday because that's the holiday we're trying to get back to.
And how does that answer that we follow Beit Hillel?
It does not. That's a great question. Yes, meaning
that's separate.
Meaning I'm only telling you about the psychology of Beis Shammai,
right.
And again, it's not that Beis Hillel even necessarily rejected that notion. He just said that there's a competing value, right? He was perfectly aware of the comparison. No one in the Gemara came and said, no, that's not a valid comparison, right? We accepted that Beis Shammai's comparison was a legitimate comparison.
But
right?
It's just void of this whole concept.
Correct. I mean, and not every component of Hanukkah, is touches on this notion. But neither does any other component of Hanukkah contradict this notion.
It could be that Beit Hillel.